The struggle continues today, including right here in the DMV. Also, anniversaries for the Black Lives Matter movement and Hiroshima Nagasaki activists. All that and more coming up next. And welcome to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the on-the-ground edition for August 6, 2015, on 89.3 FM, your Pacifica listener-powered station for jazz and justice in the nation's capital. On the Ground and onthegroundshow.org are devoted to coverage of social justice activists and activism here in the DMV, the nation, and around the planet. I'm Esther Averam. Well, three anniversaries are converging. 50 years ago today, the Voting Rights Act was signed into law, and the struggle continues 50 years later, including for 40,000 disenfranchised people living right here in Maryland. 70 years ago today, the United States dropped the first of two atomic bombs on Japanese islands, killing 129,000 people. And Sunday marks the one-year anniversary of the killing of unarmed teenager Michael Brown by former Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson, and the Ferguson uprising that followed. So as always, we have a lot in this hour, starting with our headlines. Today at 5:30 p.m., hundreds are expected to mark the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act with a rally at Pratt and Light Streets in downtown Baltimore to call on the Maryland General Assembly to override Governor Hogan's veto this past May of legislation that would allow 40,000 of the formerly incarcerated to vote. An override next January would unlock the vote for thousands of Marylanders who continue to be barred from voting due to past criminal records. African Americans and Baltimore residents are the majority of those disenfranchised. Earlier this year, the Maryland General Assembly passed legislation to reinstate the vote to all former prisoners living in our communities who are denied the vote because they are on probation or on parole. So this victory for voting rights won passage by an overwhelming margin, but after that big victory, Governor Hogan vetoed the legislation on May 22nd. First-term Congresswoman Alma Adams, Democrat of North Carolina, told VOA News that the significance of the Voting Rights Act and efforts to undermine it around the country should not be diminished.
As a result of the marching and the protesting and really getting the ear of the right people, now we have that right to vote. Now, but when you look at states like North Carolina, that immediately after the Supreme Court made its ruling and struck out Articles 4 and 5, or at least adjusted them in a way that would not require states like North Carolina to be pre-cleared, those things threaten the rights that we have attained in terms of voting. When you have laws in North Carolina that are some of the most egregious to require an ID, a voter ID, a picture ID, to eliminate one-stop voting, to eliminate early registration for young students and that kind of thing, those things undermine what the Voting Rights Act was really designed to do. And I believe that they are going to create problems. And I'm hoping that in our state of North Carolina and any other state where we are in the courts with this, that we're able to get a victory so that we don't lose the rights that we've gained. And all those people who died, who were beaten and abused, like Congressman John Lewis, will not have done all of that in vain.
Congresswoman Alma Adams, Democrat of North Carolina, will have more about today's important action in Baltimore and speak to two of the organizers after headlines. As the Republican candidates for president are set to debate tonight in Cleveland, the organization Color of Change is challenging the candidates to take a stand about police violence and killings of particularly unarmed black women and voting rights activist went to challenge Jeb Bush for his role as former governor of Florida in the 2000 presidential election that was awarded to his brother, George W. Bush, after hundreds of people were illegally thrown off the ballot rolls in Florida. The United Nations Human Rights Committee has just given the U.S. failing grades on human rights, including failing standards on gun violence, on the controversial Stand Your Ground laws, personal privacy, and gun violence. The committee said that the U.S. did provide information on convictions of four Blackwater contractors for their crimes in Iraq and on other prosecutions or convictions of U.S. personnel after the invasion of that country. But the committee noted what it called limited replies on questions related to firearms and on surveillance. The committee said that while it welcomed some measures taken regarding transfer of detainees from Guantanamo, more information was needed. In another new report, Amnesty International finds military police in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, have killed more than 1,500 people in the past 5 years. Amnesty said nearly one in six homicides in Rio were carried out by on-duty police as part of a strategy of fear in favela communities. The vast majority of the police victims were young black men. Rio de Janeiro is set to host the Summer Olympics in 2016. A Republican bid to end federal funding for Planned Parenthood has failed in the Senate. The vote was 53-46, seven votes short of the 60 needed to advance the defunding bill. The bid came after an anti-choice group released secretly recorded, highly edited videos of Planned Parenthood employees discussing how they share fetal tissue with researchers, a practice Planned Parenthood says is performed legally and never for profit. Senator from Hawaii, Mazie Hirono, was among those who defend Planned Parenthood. She said, Indiana at one point defunded Planned Parenthood. In one of the counties, Scott County, that Planned Parenthood clinic performed most of the STD examinations. That county is now in the midst of an HIV crisis. So they actually had to put up a pop-up clinic to deal with that crisis and to provide those services that had previously been performed by Planned Parenthood in that county. And those were the words of Senator Mazie Hirono of Hawaii. Now, shut it down for Mike Brown will happen this Saturday at 7 p.m. at the African American Civil War Memorial. This will be a rally and march in memory of Mike Brown and other police terror victims. That will happen again this Saturday at 7 p.m. at the African American Civil War Memorial at 1925 Vermont Avenue in Northwest D.C. And earlier that day at 3 p.m. in Baltimore, the People's Power Assembly is gathering at Pennsylvania and North Avenues for the National Day of Protest, Resistance, and Commemoration from Mike Brown to Freddie Gray, from Ferguson and Baltimore to South Carolina, Stop the War on Black America. And related in our culture and media moment, The Counted is a project by The Guardian and TheGuardian.com. And the public is working with The Guardian to count the number of people killed by police and other law enforcement agencies in the United States throughout 2015 and to monitor their demographics and to tell the stories of how they died. So far at the website, they have documented 683 people that have been killed just this year alone by the police here in the U.S. Other grim findings include the fact that this country is on track to have 1,100 police killings this year, that police in this country kill more people in days than other countries do in years, and that black Americans killed by police are twice as likely to be unarmed as whites. The database will combine Guardian reporting with verified crowd-sourced information to build a comprehensive record of such fatalities. The Counted is the most thorough public accounting for deadly use of force in the U.S., but it will operate as an imperfect work of progress, say the organizers, and will be updated by Guardian reporters and interactive journalists as frequently as possible. So the government right now has no comprehensive record of the number of people killed by law enforcement. This lack of basic data has been glaring amid the protests, riots, and worldwide debates set in motion by the fatal police shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson a year ago. Before stepping down as U.S. Attorney General earlier this year, Eric Holder described the prevailing situation on data collection as unacceptable. So the public is encouraged to support this project and to submit information to Project Counted by going to theguardian.com/thecounted. That's theguardian.com/thecounted. And I want to thank WPFW listener Jabari Zakia for sending me information about the Counted Project. Also, there are several events and actions happening here in the DMV to commemorate the 70th anniversary of the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, including a U.S.-Japan Concert for Peace sponsored by the Nuclear Free Tacoma Park Committee and the D.C. Labor Chorus at the Sam Abbott Citizens Center Auditorium, 7500 Maple Avenue in Tacoma Park, Maryland, and that's this Saturday evening, featuring Miss Yuki Ikebe with the Heartful Chorus and the D.C. Labor Chorus. For the past 34 years, the Hiroshima-Nagasaki Peace Committee of the National Capital Area has been organizing for the abolition of nuclear weapons and nuclear power and in support of nuclear victims. They believe that if the world is to avoid repeating the horrors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, it must strive to keep alive the memory of the bombings. So for more information, you can contact John Steinbeck 1 at Verizon.net. That's John Steinbeck 1 at Verizon.net. And The Look of Silence, Joshua Oppenheimer's powerful companion piece to his Oscar-nominated The Act of Killing, is continuing at the E Street Cinema through Oppenheimer's footage of perpetrators of the 1965 Indonesian genocide. A family of survivors discovers how their son was murdered, as well as the identities of the killers. The massacre of up to 1 million communists, leftists, ethnic Chinese, and others in Indonesia in 1965 through 1967 is a foundational event in modern Indonesian political history, but it remains mostly a footnote for most in the United States and elsewhere. The documentary, The Act of Killing, shocked audiences as perpetrators of the mass murder reenacted their violence. The film has fueled a debate within Indonesia and drawn attention internationally to events unknown to many, events that the U.S. facilitated and cheered at the time. This film initiates and bears witness to the collapse of 50 years of silence. It is a winner of over a dozen international awards, including the Grand Jury Prize at the Venice Film Festival and Audience Award for Festival Favorite at the Southwest Film Festival. It is scheduled to continue at the E Street Cinema. Okay, so those are our headlines and happenings. When we come back, a call to unlock the vote for 40,000 Marylanders who have served their time, paid their debt to society, but are still denied the right of their citizenship, the right to vote. We'll be speaking to two organizers who will be rallying and marching in downtown Baltimore in about 5 hours to urge the Maryland General Assembly to overturn the veto by Governor Larry Hogan of legislation that will restore this right to those on probation and on parole. And we'll talk about the links between police brutality, police killings, mass incarceration, and its aftermath. Stay with us.
One that's done all the things you set out to do. Stand.
There's a cross for you to bear.
Things to go through if you're going anywhere.
Things you want are real.
You have you to complete, and there is no deal.
There's a midget standing tall,
and a giant beside him about to fall.
And welcome back to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the on-the-ground edition. That was Sly and the Family Stone on our show this morning. And I just got a call from Lucy Murphy letting me know that the concert with the D.C. Labor Chorus and the Tacoma group the concert is tomorrow on Friday, not Saturday. And that is the concert that will be the concert for U.S.-Japan peace. And you can get more information at johnsteinbeck1@verizon.net. And thanks, Lucy, for calling and let me know about that. All right. So, today, nearly 40,000 Marylanders, the great majority of whom are African American, continue to be barred from voting due to past criminal records. Baltimore residents are the majority of those disenfranchised. Well, earlier this year, the Maryland General Assembly overcame its inertia and partisan politics and actually passed legislation to reinstate the vote to all former prisoners living in our communities, but denied the vote because they are on probation or parole. This victory for voting rights won passage by an overwhelming margin in the legislature. But after that big victory, Governor Larry Hogan vetoed the legislation. That was Senate Bill 340, House Bill 980 on May 22nd. So starting at 5:30 p.m. today at Pratt and Light Streets in downtown Baltimore, there will be a rally to unlock the vote, to call on the General Assembly to override that veto. And override this coming January would unlock the vote for thousands in time for the 2016 elections. So joining me to discuss today's action in Baltimore around disenfranchisement and the new Jim Crow right here in Maryland are two activists working to reinstate this right of citizenship. John Comer and Perry Hopkins are organizers with Communities United, a grassroots membership group of low to moderate income individuals and families in Maryland. Their mission is to organize communities to build power, to win transformative change for social, economic, and environmental justice in partnership with labor unions, community organizations, faith-based organizations, and many others. They seek to build a movement that deeply transforms the challenges facing Maryland's low and moderate income communities. They are joining me this morning via Skype. Good morning, John and Harry. We are going to be working as we talk to improve our connection. You sound a little scratchy to me, but hopefully the sound will improve as we proceed. So your action today in downtown Baltimore is timed to coincide with the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Voting Rights Act. So first talk about the significance of you tying together this legislation with the anniversary of the Voting Rights Act. You can start, John.
So we want to pretty much mark how far we have come since 1965 in the voting rights area, more specifically in the African American community, and now we are still fighting for our voting rights, much of it being in the African American community, since it's dealing with the level of mass incarceration, and mass incarceration incarcerates mostly African American men and women.
Right.
So we want to continue to push for the override that needs to take place in the Maryland legislature, because Governor Hogan decided to veto the bill once it reached his desk. And, you know, there are too many people in Maryland that are affected by this and too many people that actually want to see this passed.
Right. So Martin O'Malley, who is now a presidential candidate, signed legislation in 2007 that actually restored voting rights to the formerly incarcerated who completed parole and probation. But today, 40,000 people are still disenfranchised. I mean, so I'm wondering, like, are these people who did not or cannot complete parole or probation, or are these 40,000 people on probation and parole right now?
These are, I'm Perry. Mm-hmm. These are 40,000 individuals that are now currently in society, living in our communities, most of which are working and paying taxes, and are being denied the right to vote as a result of their passing criminal record. These people are on the street right now, paying into a government that they have no voice in.
Right.
That's
right.
A big part of this rally. That's a big part of this bill.
You know, of course, you know, preparing for the show, I couldn't help but think about, you know, Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, and that whole, how it's been really adopted as a, kind of not just a slogan, but as a reality for so many people. So is the legislation in Maryland like functioning as a new Jim Crow? Or I was just thinking maybe it's just the same old Jim Crow. You know, what was the state of things before 2007 when there was the limited relief? You know, in 2007, there was this limited relief for those completing parole. What was it like before 2007?
Well, you know, this rally and this bill right now has been being built upon for a long time. There was a time prior to 2007 where an ex-felon couldn't vote at all.
Right.
It was a big legislation because it was granting limited access to the vote, you know, with the conditions of completing parole and probation. It's now time to take the next step. When someone's released from prison, they should be returned their full citizenship and all the rights that come with it. It's important. It's important not only to me, but it's important to a lot of people. Also, it needs to be noted that this isn't just on the state and local level. We're being denied the right to vote in the national election. In 2008, I missed the chance at history. I missed the opportunity to vote for this nation's first African-American president as a result of the 2007 legislation. And here we are right now facing the possibility of history again. We may very well have the first female president of the United States. These people will be shut out of not only local and state issues, but national choices as well. It's unfair, it ain't right.
And this is John. I just want to add something very quickly. The actions of the governor to veto this bill obviously demonstrates he continuously agrees with the ideology of the old Jim Crow by, pushing anti-legislation or like any legislation that will actually help to improve the quality of life of an ex-felon, or at least this specific legislation, he's not for. So obviously his thought process is a bit marred and behind. Currently.
So, speaking of the governor, I'm wondering how much of this is politically motivated. This legislation would create 40,000 new voters in Maryland, and how much is the motivation political, given the fact that we're coming up on a 2016 presidential election for the governor, who is a Republican? What do you think?
I know it's politically motivated. Because as far as recidivism goes, the statistics show that returning citizens who vote are successful in society 2-1 over those who don't. He has no statistical or policy issues to support his action. I believe personally, it's voter suppression. You know, of the 40,000 people on the street right now, disproportionately, they reflect the African-American community. You know, and it's believed that African-Americans vote Democrat. He's a Republican. And I believe this is just one of the ways that, you know, in a partisan way, he's doing what he can to shore up his party.
So, Perry, this might be a good time for you to just talk a little bit about your own personal story as someone who was formerly incarcerated and your own struggle to vote and the impact that that's had on you in the community.
Well, I have an extensive criminal record. I'm not proud of it, but I'm not ashamed of it because a lot of the struggles that I went through as a result of my criminal background has helped me to become the person that I am today. I'll share with you very briefly. I have 52 arrests, 24 convictions, and 8 violations of parole. Okay, I'm a recovering addict. I have almost 2 years clean. And I work in the community, giving back on a daily basis. I remember in 2008, it was about 10 o'clock at night. Everybody was running through the streets, cheering that we had Mr. Obama, President Obama as our president. I remember working campaign. And somebody was saying, we got our first president, first black president. And he looked at me, and I was cheering. And he said to me, well, did you vote? and it changed my life. It changed because it was, if you didn't vote, you didn't help. Mm. And it gave me a different perspective on the vote. It gave me a different perspective on the part that I can actually play. That denied me part of my legacy. I can't tell my grandkids that I was part of that. I can tell them about it. I can tell them I was there, but I can't tell them I participated. And right now, I'm working in Gilmore Homes, doing some organizing in that community, and it is horrendous. It is horrendous the amount of people who want change, but due to their criminal background, can't have an input in it. It's a big issue. I think right now it's a way that, you know, there's a lot of young politicians coming in. There are a lot of people that are hurting that want change, and they realize that it's got to start downtown. It's got to start in Annapolis. It's got to start in Washington. We're eager to become, you know, participants in the process. Tired of sitting back watching. We're not going to complain. We're going to take action. We need the ability for everybody in the community out here today, especially those amidst the struggle, to have a hand in the change.
So, you know, I wanted to go back. You were talking about your own, you know, criminal record and, you know, where you've come from. And most of those arrests, convictions were around drug. They were all around drug charges, right?
Well, some, most of them, yeah.
Yeah.
Most of them were around drug charges.
Right.
But I want you to look at a statistic that I just gave you. I was arrested 52 times, but convicted 24, less than half.
Okay.
A lot of those were, and not to bring in another issue, a lot of those were being in an impoverished neighborhood and being preyed upon by the police.
Right.
Just for the profile, for the stereotype. Look at the statistic. I gave it to you real. 52 arrests, 24 convictions. So over half of the time that I was arrested, it was an arrest.
Right.
And that's just one of the ways that I believe... the structure that we have now, the criminal justice system we have on the street, just one of the ways that they actively mar a person. If you were arrested, you were arrested. Why is that a statistic? What you were convicted for, that's a realistic statistic.
Right.
I've been turned down for jobs.
Mm-hmm.
I've completed 7 job training programs, three job readiness programs. I've been to college. CD, I couldn't get a job as a result of my criminal record. Why? Because of the policies and the laws that now exist that the vote must change.
Okay. Now, you mentioned President Obama, and a few weeks ago he made a statement, and he visited a prison, and he also made a statement about mass incarceration. And we want to kind of connect this issue of voting with mass incarceration and this anniversary of the uprising in Ferguson. So we're going to go to that clip, and then I want to give you all an opportunity to respond.
Sure, thank you.
The United States is home to 5% of the world's population, but 25% of the world's prisoners. Think about that. Our incarceration rate is 4 times higher than China's. We keep more people behind bars than the top 35 European countries combined. And it hasn't always been the case. This huge explosion in incarceration rates. In 1980, there were 500,000 people behind bars in America. 500,000 people in 1980. I was in college in 1980. Many of you were not born in 1980. That's okay. I remember 1980. 500,000. Today, there are 2.2 million. It has quadrupled since 1980. Our prison population has doubled in the last 2 decades alone.
So that was President Obama speaking recently before the NAACP. And so that kind of ties into our issue about, we're speaking about today, this new Jim Crow. We're marking on this show the anniversary of the killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, which did not start the Black Lives Matter movement, but certainly ignited it. And in Maryland and Baltimore in particular, people are making the link between the issues of police brutality, mass incarceration, and all the after effects of mass incarceration, such as disenfranchisement. So I wanted to give you, both Perry and John, a chance to comment on his remarks and right now.
this is John Comer. Finally we have a president who's paying attention to some of the most glaring issues that are taking place in our community. Some of the most hurtful and devastating issues which continue to leave our communities in peril. It's long overdue. And it's good to see that on a federal level, in a position that's as powerful as the presidency, that something is being done about that. But it's no time to celebrate, because we have to remember the effects of incarceration and the amount of people coming back home into our communities and the unwelcoming system that will not allow them back into society, that we have a lot of work to do.
Yes.
We have to be mindful of what's ahead, the negative effects of prison, and how it can turn a person's behavior to be counterproductive. So we have to organize, and that's what we're here for.
You know, very good point, John. You know, it is refreshing to hear someone in power talk about the issues of the people. You know, this thing, you know, here in Baltimore, I'll share this with you. Here in Baltimore, we had somebody called Glenn Denning, and he instituted a zero tolerance policy in Baltimore of all laws. So we're imperfect beings striving for perfection. Zero tolerance, no discretion. If you jaywalk, boom, you're going to jail. Imagine. That's how I accrued some of those arrests. That was the mentality. No, that was a tool to get. That was a tool to get people behind bars. Also, this is the issue, and a lot of what's going on is this. I personally committed a crime. I own up to mine. I did it. All right. I was sentenced in a criminal court for a criminal offense. Upon my release, I began serving a new civil sentence. Governor Hogan has waged a civil war on ex-felons with this issue in his veto. You want to fight, we're going to give it to you. It's not right. Voting is a civil right. Employment, civil issue. Housing, civil issue. Schools, civil issue. Okay, we're being banned out of all of these different arenas. You wow. call it, you know, they call it reentry. I call it resentencing.
Okay. You know, you're really bringing up some very important points that I want us to cover after the break. But we're going to have to go to a brief break right now. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition. I'm your host, Esther Averam, and I'm in conversation with John Comer and Perry Hopkins, organizers with Communities United, two of the organizers who will be rallying this afternoon in downtown Baltimore at Pratt and Light Streets to unlock the vote for 40,000 Marylanders on probation or parole, most of whom are African American and living in Baltimore. We'll continue the discussion after the break. What they're trying to do is override a veto by Governor Larry Hogan of legislation that would allow those on probation or parole to vote. And you can join our discussion after the break by calling 202-588-0893. That's 202-588-0893. Stay with us.
When you've done all you can, and it seems like nothing left to do. You just stand and watch the Lord see you through. Yes, after you've done all you can, you just stand. Tell me, how do you handle the guilt of your past?
And welcome back to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the on-the-ground edition for 89.3 WPFW, your Pacifica listener-powered station for jazz and justice in the nation's capital. On the Ground and onthegroundshow.org are devoted to coverage of social justice activists and activism here in the DMV, the nation, and around the planet. I'm Esther Averam, here in conversation with John Comer and Perry Hopkins, organizers with Communities United, two of the organizers who will be rallying this afternoon at 5:30 p.m. in downtown Baltimore at Pratt and Light Streets to unlock the vote for 40,000 Marylanders on probation or on parole, most of whom are African-American and many folks living in Baltimore. And you can join the discussion by calling 202-588-0893. That's 202-588-0893. So, Perry, you were talking about how this issue of disenfranchisement actually is really just kind of the tip of the iceberg in terms of the many rights stripped of the formerly incarcerated. Do you want to elaborate on that some more?
Sure. I've done 5 years three times, 4 years once. I got experience in what I'm talking about. It's really tragic. To me, it's a way of keeping the oppressed oppressed. You talked about Jim Crow. I talk about Jim Crow and the Old Boy Network, where those who have are getting and those who need get nothing. This is why. You know, their system is designed to get returning citizens back, where they can make more money off you behind bars than, you know, you're worth to them on the street. It's very evident with this governor. He took $30 million out of education and wanted to put it into a juvenile detention center, which means you got plans on locking them up earlier.
Well, that wasn't under this governor, right? You're talking about the former
I'm talking about Mr. Hogan.
Okay.
Okay. You know, here in Baltimore, things are, you know, if you come and you stay for a little while, you can see the evidence of what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. I mean, returning home, you know, one, you go through the culture shock, you know, you gotta deal with, you know, the socialization issues. You got the post-traumatic stress from being locked up. A lot of times you're returning back to society from past behaviors. You're looking for a break and you don't know. They don't tell you that the deck's stacked against you. You're clearly qualified. I've gone to six jobs, been hired, given the uniform, put on the floor to work, and been called to HR and told we can't use you because of your criminal record.
Yeah, I know. A lot of people have had that experience, and so in many ways what we're saying is that this disenfranchisement is the tip of the iceberg, but that will be the focus of the rally this afternoon, 5:30 p.m. at Pratt and Light Streets in Baltimore. We actually have a few callers, so if you two gentlemen can hold on and listen to our callers, and we can respond to them as well. Let me go to the first caller. Just say your first name and where you're calling from.
Is that me?
Yes, that's you.
How you doing?
I'm good.
That's good. Good greetings, everybody. My name is K.O. I'm calling from D.C. And I got an analogy. They talk about the incarceration and the terrible treatment that the people get after being punished. But what I'm looking at is what the president didn't speak on, as far as I know, he didn't speak on this private industry. In other words, I use the analogy as my mother, when I was growing up, she was the government of my life. That means she was the punisher and the caregiver, so she was totally total government. And that's the same as if I broke her law, which I used to do all the time. If I broke her law, instead of her doing what she used to do, was whip my behind and punish me by putting me in my room somewhere, or whatever. What if she sent me on the other side of town and paid some people to keep me in their basement, okay, and do whatever they want to me, and she gonna pay them? That's the same as this evil government that we got. This paying individuals, private persons, private companies, private corporations, private entities, to keep human beings in cages, okay, for profit. And nobody's saying nothing about that. If you're the government, you're supposed to represent, I think they say, in God we trust, in freedom, justice, and democracy. And what kind of freedom is it you're going to pay somebody to get filthy rich off incarcerating human beings and putting them in cages?
Okay.
Something needs to be said about that. It should be an abomination, totally illegal. The government should be doing that, just like the government's supposed to print the money instead of giving it to these vampires. I got to go.
Okay. And well, thank you for for your comments before you go. The prison industrial complex, that's what he's talking about. And we've certainly talked about that a lot here on this show, and we'll continue to. Let me just go to the next caller and just say your first name and where you're calling from.
RGDC, glad to weigh in today on your show. Wanted to get your take and your guest take on the president's soundbite clip speaking about incarceration rates comparatively from 1980 to the present. What about the you know, I can just see and have seen and reiterated and reinforced in my own mind the loss of the industrial base in the country, and then the revamping of criminal law to with mandatory minimums and other regressive and draconian sentencing measures where criminal law is concerned. So, but mainly, he compared it to China. Now, it doesn't take necessarily rocket science to figure out how much of the industrial base has been shifted directly to China from the United States, beginning with that 1980 to the present period.
Right.
And so I think it's certainly an economic consideration, capitalistically above and beyond as a driver behind the rest of the social issues that we're discussing. I don't know what you feel about it or your guess.
Well, you know, RG, I think you've said it all. You've already said it. I think I agreed with you wholeheartedly. I don't know if my guests want to weigh in.
Okay, thank you.
Perry or John, did you want to add to or comment on RG's comment?
I mean, he pretty much summed it up. He summed it up very well. There are just a set of laws that have been on the books for too long, and they're being reinforced, such as this policy that we passed through the state legislature that got to the governor's desk and was vetoed. More so than often, the organizing piece is very important for our communities, because these things are happening behind closed doors, seemingly, if you're not paying attention. And, you know, in this world, so much about being an individual now and taking care of yourself that, you know, people seem to slip into the mode of thinking that, you know, what's going on at city council, what's going on at city hall, the state legislature and Congress doesn't affect them, but it does. And, you know, it just goes to show through the governor's veto that there is 40,000 people that he doesn't want to free up. Because if he does and they actually get some kind of education about themselves in the process, that him and his way of ruling will not be around much longer. So as organizers, it's very important, organizers everywhere, everyday people, it's very important that we talk to each other, spread the message, spread the news about what's going on, because people don't see these privatized prisons and everything that's going on until we reach 2.5 million people that are incarcerated. And then you can ask yourself whether we're reacting too late, which we are, you know, which we are definitely being retroactive on this situation. We need to try to be a lot more proactive.
I'm sorry, John, go ahead.
I'm sorry, Perry chiming in. Mm-hmm. Like I said, he summed it up. But, you know, this thing is supposed to be hidden. The beauty of what's going on right now is he exposed himself. He won the battle with the veto. We're going to win the war with the override. Because, you know, just as John said, there's 40,000 people out there that he does not want in the process. That's the message. Here in this town, that's enough. There's enough people out there, when we get this override, that can swing that election. That needs to be realized, see, because he realizes it. And at Communities United, between John and I, we're going to do everything we can to empower those people and swing an election. Okay. It's time for change, and it's time for action.
Okay, and you know, the only other point that I thought about in relationship to RG's comment was the fact that Baltimore was such a industrial town and such a town filled with so many factories and ways that people in the working class could make a living. And most of those jobs, factories, have been shut down. The jobs have been exported overseas. And even when we had the uprising after Freddie Gray's death, you know, the owner, I believe, of the Orioles, you know, made that point and just talked about how cities, states needed to invest in communities, invest in jobs so that people would not have those kinds of choices, would not have that type of situation that even Freddie Gray found himself in. I remember Reverend Jamal Bryant called it a quarter-life crisis at being 25 and not really having opportunities and not having just the type of opportunities that he could have with investment in him as a human being. But we have a full bank of phone calls, so let me just get a few more people in, okay? Just let me go to the next caller. Say your first name and where you're calling from.
Good morning, my sister, Tesfa.
Hey, Tesfa.
How are you?
Okay.
This beetle has done something any of us have thought about. That is, someone stole candy or got caught with ganja and got sentenced through the judiciary to a certain number of months or years in prison. Once that's done, he is a legal person. But by vetoing what the legislature passed, he passed a new law. Someone who stole something, someone who snored something, is sentenced to death. If someone cannot have a job, if someone cannot have a shelter, then that person is killed.
Right.
This is a death sentence. This looks like he has become, the executive has become the legislature, the executive has become the judiciary. This is dictatorship, like the Ethiopian one, like the Rwandan kind.
Do you see what I'm saying? Yes, absolutely. Thank you, Tesfa. Let me go to the next caller. Just say your first name and where you're calling from. Go ahead. You're on the air. I can't hear you so well.
Hey, how you doing? Can you hear me?
Yes, now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm Joe, caller from Baltimore. I just wanted to shed some light on the origins of how these laws came into being. After Reconstruction, the South is looking for a way to disenfranchise blacks. Through the black codes and through taking away what should have been a federal right on a state level. Mm-hmm. There's a lawmaker from Virginia. His name was E.C. Glass. There's a big football school named after him in Virginia to this day. He said, and I quote, he said, "Gentlemen, this bill we're about to pass will eliminate darkies influence in Virginia politics for years to come." So the origins of taking away the right to vote for felons, the origins are racist origins to disenfranchise blacks and dilute their political power. And in this day and age, in this new century, why would we allow a law that's been based in racism to still stand? That's my comment. Thank you for your time.
Exactly.
Oh, and thank you for making your comment. 202-588-0893. Let me go to the next caller. Just say your first name and where you're calling from.
Jay-Z from DC. I just want to say I concur with the gentleman there, but also one of the things we need to look at, rights under the Constitution, so-called rights under the Constitution, are inalienable, which means that as soon as you're born, you possess these rights. And a state can't take away something that it didn't grant. It does not privilege you. So all of these laws are unconstitutional because states have no rights to grant you the right to vote. It's yours once you're born. And therefore, they have no authority and power to take it away from you under any conditions. In Vermont, which is one of the most homogeneous white states in the nation, in Vermont, you can vote while you can vote while you're in prison, because in Vermont, they recognize that your citizenship doesn't end just because you're under a state of incarceration. It's lucky that, you know, they have maybe 1% black population. But philosophically, they recognize that the act of incarceration is a punishment for the crime, not a punishment for the citizenship. So I also would just urge, if it's not already the case, that this needs to be made a part of the upcoming 20th anniversary 10-10 March. I'm hoping and assuming that hopefully the gentleman and other people can make this a part of the platform, because what we really need is a federal law. Instead of going state by state, the best thing to do is challenge this on the constitutionality of states to deprive American citizens of inalienable rights. Okay, thank you.
Okay, and thank you. You know, we've had a couple callers. Did you have any thoughts you wanted to add? We're kind of running out of time, but I wanted to give you a chance to catch up if you had some thoughts. Period.
Yeah, many times when I speak to people, I say that some of us are born into the world while others are born into a system. And so on the people we organize, these are the folks who are born into a system. I totally agree with much of what the gentlemen were saying before. But, you know, since we are pressed for time, you know, I know that Perry and I would like to make a call.
I personally, everything you said, man, it has touched me. If you guys haven't realized it, this is a personal, and I'm very passionate about this issue. I'm going to invite you out. We need you. There are people who cannot help themselves that can use your help today. Show up. 5:30, Pratt and Light.
Okay? And I just want to stress that, you know, although this rally is about one issue, overall, this is about unity. Yes. And the more issues that we can begin to address, the more unity that we can have moving forward. So like you were saying earlier, it's the tip of the iceberg. But we're dealing with a huge community of ex-felons. And anywhere that we can galvanize support, that's where we need to do it. And so at the end of the day, this rally is so much more about now, but also about the later and moving forward, because we have so many issues, glaring issues in our communities that have to be addressed.
Also, I want to say this too, not only to the ex-felons and the ex-offenders, when we go to jail, we take our family with us.
Right.
The mothers, who sends you a package, who writes you, who comes to see you, guess what? They're doing the sentence with you. They're invited as well. No. We want to make some changes so when you come home, you're not a burden to the household. You don't become another mouth to feed. That's what this is about. No. There's a lot of people who are in prison right now listening, unable to participate in the process. Remember when we were locked up, how we felt? We wanted help from the outside. But now you got a chance to give back to those who are home and those who have yet to come home by empowering them with the God-given right in this country to vote. Show up today at 5:30. My name is Perry Hopkins, and you will see me. I got a place for you at the front of the line. Okay. Lead this march. Okay. Be with us. I'll see you at 5:30.
Okay. And so that'll have to do it for us on Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition. I've been speaking with John Comer and Perry Hopkins, organizers with Communities United, communitiesunited.org, a grassroots membership group of low to moderate income individuals and families in Maryland. And they will be rallying this afternoon at 5:30 p.m. in downtown Baltimore at Pratt and Light Streets to unlock the vote for 40,000 Marylanders on probation or parole who are denied the right to vote. And you can connect with them there. I'm Esther Verm, and I want to give a special thanks again to my guests, John Comer and Perry Hopkins. And thanks to my engineer today, Michael Vernon. And thank you so much for listening and supporting your station for Jazz and Justice. You can reach the show at onthegroundshow.org, where you can now listen to all of our shows and past shows. Please like our Facebook and Twitter pages at On the Ground Show. Now stay tuned for the news, followed by Krista Property on the Thursday edition of Don't Forget the Blues. Raise your voice. Peace.
steps.
¶¶